Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard. And today is an exciting episode because it's an interview with Kristen Gerwick. And Kristen is the writer and director of The Wind Phone, which besides winning a ton of awards at Film Invasion Los Angeles in 2019, has qualified for the Oscars. In other words, the Oscars look at a certain number of short films every year that are at Oscar-qualifying festivals, and it made it through the first round, so to speak. So it's entirely possible that 2 weeks from now, they will announce it's on the short list for the Oscar for Best Live-Action Short. And I have to tell you, it's a wonderful film. It's an incredible film. There's a reason it won so many awards at Film Invasion in June. And to be honest, she and I even talked about the Oscars, and I said something to her along the lines, I think it was off the mics, we'll find out. But I said something like, you know, if your film doesn't get nominated for an Oscar, then I don't even understand what they're looking for. So maybe I do understand, who knows? So anyway, I do have friends, and hopefully even people I don't know who are going to hear this, who are either Oscar voters, or they have friends who are Oscar voters. We're in Los Angeles, almost, you know, everybody's neighbor has someone who knows someone in the Academy. And I gotta say, urge everyone to watch The Wind Phone. Just watch The Wind Phone. If you watch it, I have no doubt that you will want it to be on that short list for the Best Live Action Short Oscar. Is there anything else I have to set up? Normally I talk about the festivals and TV series. Yeah, Discover Indie Film is a TV series on Amazon Prime Video. So just search for Discover Indie Film on Amazon Prime Video and see some wonderful short films. But you know what? I will end this introduction and let's just start talking to Kristen.
My dad is a film buff, just by hobby. So he was actually showing me films that were probably not even like appropriate for me to see rating wise. My mom was always like, oh, you know, I remember growing up watching films like Goodfellas or Reservoir Dogs and Thin Red Line.
Like under 10 or?
Yeah, around like 10
That's
going
excellent.
Forward.
That's
yeah.
Excellent.
So, I remember Platoon and the opening of Apocalypse Now. And, yeah, I think growing up, my favorite movie, I loved Goodfellas. I loved those characters. It was just like a benchmark. There's definitely some part of my work, the series I'm working on now, it's actually a crime drama. And I just loved the full life that the characters had and how much you fell in love with them, even though they were doing atrocious things. So I think it definitely sparked a part of my brain and an interest in the dark side of things too. So yeah, my mom definitely didn't appreciate that.
At that age, you didn't notice like the craft of it, but it was there, right?
Yeah,
it was there for
you
to notice.
You know what? It's really what you do know is you know a film that resonates emotionally. You know when I could feel when something fell flat, and I could feel when something really resonated emotionally, and there were characters you fell in love with, and from that age, you know, I think subconsciously that was there in my mind was really that, you know, plots are wonderful, but it's the characters that we fall in love with and we can watch do anything. And it was the characters that always stuck in my mind.
Absolutely. If you don't care about the people in the story, you can't care about the story.
Yeah, exactly. And I always feel that, you know, when creating my own work that I always move my way in through the characters because they're going to dictate the plot and the choices. And so I think at an early age that stuck in my mind. And I often too, as a child would, and I didn't realize this until I was older, is I was always playing out movies in my mind. I would listen to music and orchestrate scenes of things I would like to happen in school or fantastic situations playing out in my mind.
Like directing music videos in your head almost?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And I did it quite often. And I liked the freedom that I felt in that world. And I also, too, was a very a lucid dreamer quite often. So in the morning, I kind of would have these dreams where I could create what would happen next, where I was aware I was dreaming. And that's actually still something that when it does fall upon me now, creatively, I'm so grateful for it. Because if there's a project I'm working on where I'm blocked, That's why I tell people, I'm like, sometimes the best thing to do is take a nap or relax, because when you release that pressure you want to create or to crack a story, sometimes the brain is still working on it when you don't even realize it, and you relax, it presents itself to you.
Absolutely.
So I oddly, even though my dad was a film buff, they didn't really, though, support a career in the arts.
Right. Just like appreciation.
You can become a lawyer or a doctor. Right. There was just no in between. And my teacher when I was younger was like, she's a storyteller. She's a great writer. She needs to be telling stories. And my mom was like, that's great. But, you know, she's going to become a lawyer or a doctor.
Right.
She's
can not- do that when, with once you have your graduate degree, you're...
Yeah. I mean, I think they were even shocked when I made that transition, actually. We'll get that later in my story. But yeah, I think, you know, most parents think of, you know, career in the arts as like the starving artist or the depressed writer who drinks too much. And
it
I guess who wants
it
that?
It scares them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it really wasn't in my mind at that time that that was even an option as a career. It was more just my private world and something that other people would notice, you know, that was kind of a part of my essence or personality. Even when I was, you know, in a world where, I mean, in college I was a econ poli sci major with like a 4.0 and super nerd.
Right.
But
what,
I was
what college?
So I went to Colgate University.
Yeah.
Actually,
I didn't ask where you grew up.
So I grew up on Long Island.
Okay.
Yeah. So obviously those, you know, those films like Carlito's Way and Goodfellas.
Yeah, another reason why Goodfellas would resonate.
Yeah,
right?
The New York kind of heavy piece. So a lot of those films really were favorites of mine. And growing up on Long Island is, you know, it's still suburbia, but you have access to New York. You just hop on a train. So you still grow up pretty fast there. You know, I didn't grow up, thank God, in the age of social media. I actually don't know how children do that today.
It is a totally different ballgame, right? The idea of, I'm also the era of YouTube, right? Because the idea of throwing up videos of yourselves being stupid.
It's amazing in the way that, you know, I think it's created a platform even for kids to share stories. And I know I was just at Heartland and there was, they had the high school filmmakers, and there was a girl that was 13 or 14 who had done a film. And it's incredible how I think social media and just the online world can facilitate that. But I'm glad that I missed it, because it forced me to live a lot in my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And read and, you know, act out things when I was a kid playing with my friends, or, you know, we just had to find different ways to entertain ourselves.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that.
Right. And you went to Colgate poli sci and econ, you said.
Yes.
Very, very responsible majors.
Yes. And I mean, I enjoyed poli sci because I enjoy history. I enjoyed learning about other culture. I actually studied Japanese culture in college.
So I see a connection there.
Yeah. So it's always been, an interest of mine. You know, econ just happened because I also had a mind that was just great with numbers.
Yeah.
It was just...
Right. So you were the rare person who was a great writer and creative, but you also loved the logic of numbers and math.
Yeah. And yeah. I see that even in writing still.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that part of my brain, it's still with me, and it brings a certain order to the madness sometimes, and logic, even though creativity is not always logic, but you know,
no,
when you have
you
to structure
have an
a
element
story,
of structure, like architecture, like if you don't,
yeah.
Yeah,
it's great for the architecture. I mean, I now use a calculator. If I look back at what I did in college, I used to, you know, do like 8-page equations. Like I don't, now it looks like Chinese to me. I don't use that part of my brain anymore. But I'm also ambidextrous, oddly. So they say if you're ambidextrous, you use sometimes both parts of your brain more. I don't know if that's really true. So it could be a myth, but
I buy it.
I'll go with it. So I was actually, I was finishing college and, I was going to go work on Wall Street, or go to law school. I had applied to UCLA and I was actually ready to work. I wanted to get out into the life experience of the world. I was very eager. Well, actually, what I really wanted to do was create, but I was hoping somehow that would come along with it, with, you know, being free from your parents.
Or, like, you could kick ass on Wall Street, and then on the weekends paint or something, or,
yeah,
or write,
exactly,
you know,
or
write for a literary journal, yes, kind of thing.
Yeah. Journalism was actually something I considered right before I turned to screenwriting. But then my parents convinced me to go to law school, and I was like, you know what? I'll be in L.A. You know, I'm getting closer, you know what I mean, to being in
that
creative space.
The appeal of UCLA was also that Los Angeles is the hub of filmmaking globally.
Yeah. And that was, I think I wasn't ready to admit it because it was scary, because I've been so programmed, you know, into this more tangible career path. But I knew it would be coming at some point. So I made my way out to Los Angeles for UCLA, and I actually did exchange program with the film and television school there.
Oh, really?
They had that as an option. So that was really great.
So you got to take some classes,
mm-hmm,
in the film school at UCLA.
Yes.
Film department, while getting your JD.
Yeah. And
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was incredible. I was like, yes, I can get out of some of these law classes. Although I didn't always go to class very often. I was more, I would say, you know, being out on your own, I went straight through. I was 22 and being let loose in the city of LA, still with kind of the maturity of a college student at that point. I was,
some
interesting times. I really kind of, I think I was getting a life education, most importantly. I was spending a lot of time probably hanging out a lot in Hollywood underground, some darkness, spending a lot of time with artists. It was the time before social media too, so people actually still left their houses.
And you were far from home. You would really spread out your wings.
Yeah, and I was a little bit lonely. You know, LA can get very lonely, so I never wanted to go
home.
Yeah,
you didn't have any friends from high school or college
who
moved to LA after school?
No, I kind of came out here. I remember I used to go out by myself to meet people. They'd be like, oh, where are your friends? And I'm like, they're here. But I really went out by myself. I can't believe I'm admitting this out loud, but it's true.
I haven't heard anything editable yet, but if you want me to cut that out, we can. But that's a good ruse to say, I'm just waiting for my friends, but I can talk to you for now.
Well, I actually loved going out alone because I got to meet new people. Sometimes when you go out with a group of girls, they tend to want to stay congregated in a corner. And when I go out somewhere, I want to meet everyone in the room and find out their story. I'm always interested in finding out people's stories. And a lot of that happens sometimes by chance. Someone you have a chance collision with, that happened on my feature that I'm working on. It was just a chance collision. And this person happened to have an incredible life story.
Right.
I would say during that period, it was just, I really feel like it was a difficult period. I was putting myself through, I would say, a lot of drama and painful situations, which I would come to realize was for the lack of stimulation I was getting that I found in film later on.
Right. So law school was a bit deadening.
So you were
seeking input outside of it.
Yeah.
Stimulation.
I was going to say a Bret Easton Ellis kind of novel. Yeah, it was just kind of going down that road. And so, there was a lot of struggle during that period. I think I was very frustrated that I wasn't able to express my creativity. And I was spending so much time with artists, I think. And I didn't even realize I was just gravitating to wanting to be around artists because of the art and being able to have those conversations and to talk about their work. And I was always dating artists and weighing in on, you know, their scripts or their music. And so I think I was living vicariously for some time when I was in my other career. And then, you know, eventually I just hit the point where it really became clear to me that this was something I really needed in my life. So I started, while I was practicing law after I graduated from UCLA, I was studying at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. So I was acting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's where I really learned.
I know a lot of people who have had a very good experience there.
Yeah, really.
And they make short films, right? They have their own little thing where people are assigned to make their own shorts.
Yeah, they're very, very supportive. I was actually, I think, in a short that's of someone's actually at the school. I can't recall his name right now.
It interests me that you, in spite of the taste of of the film program at UCLA, you still finished the JD and went to work as an attorney. And then you moonlighted at the Beverly Hills Playhouse.
Yeah.
And were you writing? Were you writing stories?
Yeah, so that's kind of how it... It started, obviously, with acting and scene study, and I loved acting. I just... I didn't see that as a path for my career. And it became quite apparent to my teacher. He's like, you're very much a director as well. He's like, I can notice a lot in your scenes and your work with the other actors that you're just naturally taking on that role. And so I started writing and, you know, directing as well in the class. And I really feel like that's where I learned the most about writing and directing. And also, it gives you such an appreciation for the vulnerability of acting as well. And it's so difficult, I think, to put yourself out there all the time that way. And then to be sharing so much of yourself.
It's so hard to be good at it.
It's
so hard to be good. There's nothing kills me more than people who've never tried it or, you know, the casual observer who just sits back and watches a movie and goes, I could do that.
Yeah. It's like you have so much appreciation after scene study or directing a film. I now look back on all the films that I love and I'm like, it's magic for everything to come together.
Yeah.
And
everyone has to be wonderful.
Yeah. Because it trickles down. And so I really feel like for any director taking an acting class and actually even taking on the role of acting in scenes, not just directing, is it just gives you such a great language and understanding. And it's in my work, when I've worked with actors, they always ask me, oh, have you acted? Because I can feel that you know what I mean? That you understand what I'm trying to do here on a, I guess, more intimate level than...
It seems like you like to make connections with people. So you're not treating your actors like puppets. You're making connections with them as humans you're working with.
Yes, actually, when I have my first rehearsal with an actor, usually they come in ready to, you know, work on the scene. And I'm always like, nope, let's sit down. I want to hear about your life. So I get to know them as an individual and their life story, because that is going to bring so much life into their role and my understanding of that and how to speak with them and what their experiences entail. And to create that bond and trust between myself and the actor, it just allows for such a greater, I guess, range and freedom, because there's a trust and there's a care.
Yeah. And you're already opening the door to them. You're showing them that they can bring something to it.
Yes.
And that their job is not to meet your preconceived conception.
Right.
But that you're already respecting them as an artist.
Yeah. And I think it's so important, because, you know, we have our notion of it, but the actor is going to bring the character to life. And if you try to, you know, as a writer, especially if you wrote the piece and coming in as a director, if you try to strangle that vision, you know, or hold too tight to it, you strangle what it can become. And, you know, films and characters take on a life of their own. It's your job to be the shepherd and guide it, but you have to let it take on the life that it was meant to take on. And those choices are made when you cast and put your crew together. And
you sound exactly like Steven Soderbergh did when I went to a Q. I saw a screening of Traffic before it came out, and he did a Q&A, and he described what he does with actors, and it's exactly what you just said. So you're in good company.
Well, I'll take it. It's, you know, you become one living being.
Absolutely.
On set. And so you know, to foster that. So I really feel like my time was really well spent there.
At the
Playhouse. And from there, I went on to option a book that was on a New York Times, you know, 100 notable.
Still working? Still lawyering?
I was still lawyering,
still
So I was like, okay, like I'm doing the acting thing and I'm writing, directing, and now I'm going to option this book and develop a screenplay. And I wasn't writing, I was working as the producer, but I worked with a great writer. His name is Graham Norris. He writes on iZombie and he has a features in the works. He's super talented. And we worked on this
And he's someone
drama.
You knew through your network of friends that you'd
together? Yeah, I mean, my entertainment lawyer actually came on board during this project. And he, when we were optioning it, and then he represented Graham and suggested that he would be a great fit for this project. So I kind of got to dig in with him into this script and really developing this story. And, you know, it ended up becoming a great script and got him a lot of work. It was, you know, kind of awards piece. It went through like different, like the Stage 5 at Focus Features, you know, it was getting attention, but those pieces are just very difficult to get financed. And I think at that time it was basically the story, a true story based on the Supreme Court case that overturned the sodomy statutes in many states.
Oh.
And it began in Texas, actually. It's called Lawrence versus Texas.
That is interesting.
Yeah. I'm still hoping we can
and
revive it.
A lot of those
now.
Laws were on the books sometimes still now, right?
Yes. At that time.
And
in
look at you finding a legal oriented story
to tell.
Yeah. So
it was a nice transition, you know, from my background into that world. I mean, at that time
in Texas. And poli-sci background. And that's poli-sci. What's more political than sodomy law.
Yeah. I mean, it was actually incredible that in 1993, bestiality was legal in Texas, but not having sex with someone of the same sex.
And historically, the law had only been used against the gay community.
Yes.
And not heterosexuals.
Yes. And actually, the couple that was under that was arrested, they were just friends. And they had never even had sex, but they were it was biracial. And it was just at that time in Texas, you know, it was a really racist police force. It was this very...
So two gay men, a white and black friends in a room together got arrested.
Yeah.
And accused of sodomy.
Yeah. And the police had a very different version of events. Everyone kind of had that Rashomon effect to the story.
That sounds like a really great movie.
Yeah. Well, we're hopefully we'll do like get it revived. I want to do some... I'm thinking about maybe potentially... you know, revisiting the script and seeing what we can do to freshen it up. But the lawyer, too, that is the main character, he was in the closet. So,
really? Yeah. That's interesting.
That argued the oral arguments. Yeah, it was a very...
Did you find that... Oh, that was in the book.
That was in the book. So the book was very more historical account. So we really had to, you know, kind of take some... I mean, not creative liberties. They were all true, but really drum up that aspect of it. So hopefully, you know, some projects are just in development for years, but.
But the important thing is to have several of them.
Yeah, it kind of got me, and then introduced me to the entertainment community, which was great, because it was a strong script. And from there, I was like, I also, though, you know, it was a producer that we had a very close call to get it greenlit wanted to rewrite the opening, and I agreed. But the writer, and I totally respect it, didn't want to do that. He was very committed to the script in this form. So there began, you know, being the frustration of being a producer.
I was like,
I know that we could do this. So then I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to, you know, write my own screenplay.
Right. So those decisions are yours.
Yeah. And I'm also a believer, even though I think it's important to keep your integrity, that there's many ways to tell a story. And that the most important thing is to get the story out there. So as long as it doesn't compromise the integrity of the piece, that sometimes as a writer, you know, someone will say, can you write some, you know, I like this, but can you write it this way? And it's a challenge. And it's like, let me give it a try. Let me see, you know what I mean, if this is possible. And it's hard. You have to do a lot of rewriting as a writer, but you have to get used to that being the kind of the status quo, because different producers are going to have different visions of what they need to get a film made. And so sometimes you have to.
Yeah, so even without film school, you understood that writing is rewriting. Screenwriting is rewriting more than any other. Yeah.
And it's a process.
You can't be precious and you have to be collaborative.
You have to be collaborative and open to, you know, I love getting feedback because it always opens another channel of looking, a way of looking at things. And sometimes at one point in your life, you may feel like this scene is so necessary, but then you have a lot of life experiences and you come back and you have a different point of view. That's why it's great to step away from a script because you come back.
I've told so many writers, just don't look at it for 90 days. Take 3 months off. And then read it again.
And you'll have a completely new, fresh
take. So many things that you're in love with that you know you could let go.
Yeah. And there's things that you love, that a scene that may be wonderful, but it doesn't serve the overall story or the pacing. And sometimes some things have to go. And I think that's very difficult as a writer. And also the rewrite process and the judgment. So I kind of understood from an early point that your first draft could be terrible in your eyes, or just not, you know, you people get so, they're like, what I'm writing on the page is horrible. And I'm like, usually, you know, when you're just getting the words onto the page, it's not a masterpiece. It's, you know, it's like a painting. There's a lot of strokes that come to get the painting in its full form.
And you knew this in like your mid-20s? Mid to late?
Yeah, late 20s.
I mean, that's just a lot of artistic maturity to me. To get that. I mean, a lot of people, when they are screenwriting, especially in the beginning, they're completely addicted to, I've got to write it perfect the first time. And instead of realizing, no, you just got to get it done and then start rewriting it.
Yeah,
you know?
Rewriting it and getting feedback. It's very important. I mean, I saw a master class with Aaron Sorkin, and he was like, I'm so dependent on my readers, his trusted readers. It's very important. And the first thing he said he wants to do when he watches a scene of his is to rewrite it.
Yeah.
So, like, that's just, there's never going to be a script that's going to be perfect. You could rewrite things probably indefinitely, but at some point, you know, you reach a point where it's diminishing returns and it's time to hand
it
over.
That's another skill to know when you are okay to stop rewriting.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it can go on. So I kind of understood that. And so I took that pressure off and judgment, and I was just ready to experiment. And so I did for a Warner Brothers workshop, A Speck of Orange is the New Black. And I that's a great exercise to start with for writers, I say, because it takes a lot of the work off in terms of creating the world and the character. So you can get used to
learning how to write for an existing property.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because the most difficult part, I think, for me in the process was creating the world and the characters. That is where the true pain comes from.
Yeah, I mean, it's world building every time.
Yeah, and it takes a lot out of you and it's exhausting. So there, if you have a show that you know very well or a story, you know your characters really well because you've been watching them. So I think starting out with a spec script like that of an established show that really resonates with you is a great exercise in. And
did you debate being a TV writer or you just took it for the experience?
I just took it for the experience. It made sense to me. I was like, okay, I don't have to build this world. So I think this is a good point. I had many stories I wanted to tell. There was a list in my computer, but I realized, you know, from my process of learning after working on the script as a producer and watching that process, that I think that this was going to serve me as a writer in terms of developing my skills and just the tools, you know, the kind of the meat and potato tools, you know, versus the creative, a kind of like inspiration that comes to you. And that's kind of its, you know, its own thing. But you have to have, I think, the tools to be able to serve it up. You know, so I was getting my cutlery and my, you know, my serving space together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
From there I started taking classes again because I wanted to go back to film school, but I was still like, you know, had some, like a student loan left from film school. I mean, from law school.
Right.
So I was just like,
so you were thinking MFA.
Yeah, I was. But ultimately I started taking classes at UCLA at Extension, and there's there are a lot of great professors there that are very seasoned writers, directors, producers. They work. And you can get out of it what you want. So I had a great experience where my professors there became mentors for me and took a lot of interest in my work because they saw that I was very committed to it and I was showing promising work. And so that was really great just to have some support there in terms of, you know, screenwriting. And then I took a directing class and that's where my first short came up, Easter Monday.
Right. When you took the class, had you thought about the Playhouse days when you were told you're kind of a natural director?
Yes. After that Orange is the New Black spec, I had written a short, film called Easter Monday, and it was based on, well, it was inspired by an Iraqi cab driver I met who shared his life story with me. His wife had been killed by insurgents because her brother was helping the American army during the occupation. And then, you know, this came to me by chance. That's why I love talking to people. I'm always, you know, people are like,
right, so a cab driver was telling you his life story?
Yeah, I'm driving to the airport and I was like, where are you from? He's like, I'm from Iraq. And I was like, I would love to visit. I was very open and warm towards him. And he's like, I'm not used to receiving this reception from Americans. And we just started talking and he had told me his, you know, his life story of how he came to be in America and really the kind of the civilian plight over there during the occupation.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume that an Iraqi who's moved to America after the invasion would have been somewhat helpful to the Americans over there and been in a very complex situation.
Very complex. It was just really, and again, the politics, but there were so many civilians that assisted in our efforts over there in the occupation, and it was a very difficult decision for them because by assisting, they put themselves, their lives at risk because there was something called a black map and insurgents would kill family members or anyone related to...
Yeah, they went after them even more so than Americans.
Yeah. And it's that there's so many stories, and there's so many stories of two translators that didn't get their special immigration visas.
We turned our back on them hard.
We did. There was a documentary.
Which we did in Vietnam, too. But yeah, we did it again.
Well, the one civilian said, I felt like a used tissue.
Yeah.
Like that the, you know, the Americans blew their nose in. And a lot of them were not even granted their special immigration visas and are in hiding still. It's, and it just broke my heart. And I couldn't believe still his optimism and resilience. Like, and still his grateful attitude to be in this country. And so, you know, the journalist part of me, because at one point I had considered going to journalism school. I definitely love finding stories and unheard voices from different parts of the world. There's just so much that is untold in this world. So many points of view that just aren't always represented in mainstream cinema as well. So, I started interviewing a lot of refugees in Southern California and in hearing their stories. And I crafted this short film called Is Ramadi, and it's about two war orphans during the Iraq occupation. We spend the day with them, and they collide with two U.S. soldiers in a very dangerous area. And they're there to deliver a package that they were given by an older man. And it's very mysterious. We don't know what they have. And when they collide with the soldiers, it's a very difficult situation because there's this language barrier and things quickly unravel. And, I don't want to give it away because anyone wants to watch it, but, it shows the grayness of the situation. And it's funny, we shot on the same set as American Sniper. And that story is a very opposite point of view, where it's from the soldier's point of view and the situations are very black and white. There's a child with a bomb and it's very clear his decision.
Yes.
But unfortunately, in true combat situations, talking to a lot of officers, the problem was it was so unclear that you didn't know if necessarily a woman or a child maybe had some kind of explosive and you had to make these split second decisions. And if you get it wrong, you kill an innocent civilian. And if you get it wrong the other way, your men, you know, get killed. And it's, you know, such a mind screw to be in that situation. I thought that was so representative of like our modern day Vietnam, where there was like the advent of kind of guerrilla warfare, jungle warfare that, you know,
yeah,
was very new. And for this, it was that so many civilians sometimes were a part of these efforts. And so you didn't know who your enemy was. And those situations, you know, really take a toll too on the soldiers. So by the end of the film, you don't hate anyone. You just see how, you know, how difficult this is on everyone involved. And, it was so funny that they were shooting that. And the kid that was the star of my film was in American Sniper playing a terrorist son. So he came over to my set, which, you know, there was no lobster like in Clint Eastwood's set. There was Chipotle, but he got to star in this film. And what I think why it really resonated with audiences is because, you spent the whole day with these boys, so they became characters you cared about. And that's what I felt like needed to happen for this kind of story to be powerful. When you see, you know, different depictions of conflicts in the Middle East and the Middle Eastern characters, whether Iraq or Afghanistan, are not developed. They're one-dimensional. You just see people being shot. Yes, it's unpleasant, but you haven't heard their dreams or their story. So emotionally, the audience can't really invest with them. But when you spend time invested with these characters, and now they've collided with these soldiers who you're also invested with, it becomes a very, the stakes are raised and it becomes very emotionally traumatic for the audience. And so some people, you know, they had that feeling towards it, but it was a very beautiful experience to share. And a lot of the secondary characters on the set were refugees that had come here. And that film was half in Arabic and half in English. So I'd worked out of, got my experience first time of working out of language. Which for me, I, you know, I'm a big believer in that emotions are the human language. Yeah. So, it was challenging. I'm not going to lie, working with kids, and he didn't speak the correct dialect of Arabic. So, I had to work phonetically with him. But we had a translator there, and it was a tough set. I mean, my professor was like, this is an amazing script, but do you want to do this for your first shoot? It's wartime, guns, kids, half foreign language. You might have a horrific experience and never want to direct again. Can you just pick something a little more, you know, first time friendly? But I just knew that I had such a great team behind me, a lot of recent grads from AFI. My DP was actually with me at LA Shorts, his film Screen Next to Mine, The Wind Phone. And so many people that Luisa Nuovo.
Yes.
Yeah. She was my script supervisor. It was just a great team of people who really believed in this project. And, you know, we didn't have definitely the funding, of course, but we made it work. And, the film, you know, I was just like, I don't even know how we got a film. Cause it was a super aggressive shoot. Cause we had like 16 hours.
You had 16 hours to shoot, and how many pages?
It was seven.
So it
came down to only really 13 hours of shoot time with kids and a lot of extras and some elaborate scenes and a lot going on.
So you shot the whole film in one day
Over 2 days. The lighting, only good for certain amounts of time for this film. So, yeah, I really got, I guess I would say, a boot camp.
Trial by fire. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like, I remember when I first got onto set and I couldn't even yell action because I couldn't even believe this was happening. I'm like, wow, people have trusted enough in my vision. Everyone's here. You know what I mean? There's that responsibility as a director, like, oh my God, I need to honor them. You know what I mean? I can't let everyone else down. It was just a real feeling. And then I think 10 minutes into it, people said, they're like, you just shifted right in. It was like, you'd been there for many, you know, you'd been on a lot of sets. I felt very comfortable on set. And even despite, there was, you know, a fire marshal situation, we had a very difficult child star who was very young, and, there was a lot of challenges, but I just remained calm. And what I really learned on that set is, you know, the importance of leadership in directing, and, you know, people look to you. So if you're letting them see your kind of frantic thoughts spill out, you know, it spills out onto the set. And I realized the importance of maintaining the energy on set and keeping everyone feeling in the safe space, even if there are challenges or things that are not going right, which there usually always are.
There's things that have to go wrong. But, yeah, you have to be a supportive voice. And give that energy that this is going well, that everyone is...
Yeah, that everything is okay. Even if... we had to rewrite the ending because the child didn't... our second child, sorry, didn't want to perform the ending as written.
Really?
Yeah. So it ended up... But these are the things, the happy accidents that I talk about when I'm saying...
You're happy with a different ending.
I can't imagine any other way. And that's when I learned something else really important, too. You have to separate yourself when you write a script. I pretend that, you know, someone else gave it to me almost as a director, because I can't get attached so much sometimes to what I've written. The location is never exactly how you wrote it. You know, your actors present new ideas and life to things. And even in him presenting this roadblock, I actually ended up loving the ending. And, you know, it was a quick thing. I had to close the set.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to say, how long did it take you to whip out the new idea?
We had 10 minutes because we were like down to our last 45 minutes of shooting. People were actually crying on set because they were like, oh my God, like we worked.
We've gone so far.
Yeah. And
it's the end of day two.
Yeah. It was like the little train that could, you know what I mean? It was like that kind of mentality between us. We were like really fighting for this film. Every single person, from the extras to, you know, even our PAs, everyone was super invested. Like we got everyone to that point, you know, where everyone was like, no, we're going to get this film done. So
no, I really want to see it. And I want to read like the original version
so
that I can compare in my head, like, oh, that's what it would have been.
Yeah.
But this is what it is.
It was more simple and I think quiet and restrained, and it's what it needed. And that's when I realized, I was like, sometimes you have to let the film take on the life it was meant to take on. Or you can strangle it. And I could have said, no, I can't. And then I wouldn't have a film.
Yeah.
So, you know, we would have to go reshoot and would have to raise more funds. And, you know, maybe that would have happened. But I felt that, too. Sometimes instincts is trusting your instincts. My instinct was to, rewrite this ending and trust in this
order. I can tell you're not a quitter. I mean, your whole life story, you've taken everything to completion. So I couldn't see you just walking away from it.
I was not walking away. Yeah. I was like, we're going to do this. And actually he had to lay because he was killed. He actually, you know, at the end, and he didn't want to lay down in the dirt. He was like, I'm not doing this. And so I laid face down on the dirt. And people were like, well, I think, you know, things have gone postal here. But then...
he did it to show him how easy it is to do.
It was just like, and then he did it. Yeah. So sometimes, too, also humbling yourself. And, you know, if you're going to put an actor through something, I was like, well, if I'm asking him to do this and he doesn't want to do it, like showing him that it was okay to do it. You know, sometimes in those moments you have to... be humble or do things that
be fun. Like you were, that's how you're supposed to act around a kid anyway.
Yeah. Fluid.
They watch what we do. They don't listen to what we say.
Yeah. Working with children is super amazing in that way. They're so free, you know, and the acting that comes out of them is so beautiful in that respect because they're just not overthinking it. They're so present. And so I do love working with children. After that, I was like, oh, there was too many children.
But, one too many.
Well, then there's also the concern of, like, you know, their safety and their emotional well-being.
Safety and limits your hours. Yeah. Although, I guess you had daylight.
Right. We had that, too. But there were some shots lost just because we had a studio teacher that was very strict. I was like, we have the whole scene set up. It's 2 minutes. Like, let us shoot this. She's like, nope. Yeah. She was like, we're over the clock. So, you know, those things happen. So it's just,
she just wanted more money.
Yeah, maybe. She was really fun at the rap party. She was drinking tequila shots. I was like, oh, I couldn't be this cool on set, but
there you go. You needed tequila on set.
Yeah. Maybe for her. Yeah. Yeah. So that was, it was an experience, and we ended up getting I was like, oh, are we going to have a film? And we ended up, you know, it ended up coming together. I was worried there would be a reshoot needed, but it ended up coming together. We had a great editor that I worked closely with. And then,
It being through UCLA Extension, were you bringing everyone in yourself? Was there anyone from the class?
No, ended up kind of just, my professor was like, we didn't even make the deadline of the class. She's like, this is a great project. Like, I'm just here.
Right. But you just went off. So the Extension class got you started, but then you just made a film.
It became much bigger than that. Yeah. Cause she was like, this isn't a student film anymore. She was actually, Iraqi herself. And
what are the odds of that?
Yeah. So she was, a really great supporter, and she's a wonderful filmmaker herself. So, she was just like, just go for it. So yeah, after that, we ended up premiering in Cannes at the Emerging Filmmaker Showcase. There was 5 films there, and it was just super exciting. Cause I didn't, you know, this is my test run. I didn't expect, you know what I mean? To be going to, yeah.
You're still working as an attorney?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know when you stopped.
That I stopped there.
Right before East Ramadi?
Yeah.
Before the shoot?
Yeah. I started focusing.
You're like, I definitely can't do this. You couldn't do both anymore.
No. Yeah. I had stopped practicing law at that
summer. So you stopped practicing law and then you end up in Cannes with the first thing you do.
Yeah. It's like, what?
Not bad.
It wasn't. Yeah. It was super exciting. And the film ended up getting distribution. It played alongside a film called Land of Mine, which was a 2017 Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Film, also a wartime film. So it's on DVD and was in now, still currently, and then in theaters with that.
Oh, so they threw
film.
The short on the DVD.
Yeah, as a special material. Yeah, because they felt thematically they were a good match.
Like you pop in and it's like being at an old school theater where you see the short and then the feature.
Yeah, it was like the opening act for a great band.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Like this little band that could, and then this, you know, then Led Zeppelin goes on. But
well, sometimes you like the opening act even better.
Yeah, so that was super exciting. And then I got signed with Artists First. Well, it was Principato Young at that time, and I had done also my first pilot, which was in the ice skating world. It was a very dark.
And by that you mean directing a pilot or writing it?
Yeah.
So this is as a writer.
Yeah. Cause I needed to come up with the original pilot. It was more an assigned topic from a producer. But I ended up getting, of course, I'm a deep researcher, a very deep researcher. That's something for sure. That's a big kind of characteristic of my work. I like to immerse myself in a world, and find the voice of that world and the characters. And, you know, for me as a director or writer, my work varies so much because it's not, I never, you know, some people are very like, I have my style, and that's such a beautiful thing. But for me, the work informs me of the style of writing and directing and the tone. And, you know, that's just something that presents itself as I'm researching, that I, you know, get a feeling about and who the voices are of this world. So it was two very, like, different pieces to be doing. But then, you know, that pilot got me, you know, my meetings at studios and places that were like, oh, we love your writing. We're not going to make, and no one wants to do ice skating right now. And then, of course, I, Tanya, comes out.
Yeah, of course.
And then there's another show. I'm like, we need to reshop this show. And my managers were like, oh, what? And then it was already, there was another ice skating show that was picked up. So it's, sometimes it's those things are so about timing because they're like, oh, it's so expensive. People don't really care that much about ice skating. And it's like, yeah, people do. Like Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan. It's pretty much some of the biggest, I think it had some of the highest ratings CBS ever had in terms of viewers during that scandal. And it's quite a dark world and it breeds a lot of neuroses. And I can't, you know, having kind of like a career where 8 years of training boils down to a 2-minute program, you can imagine the pressure and the kind of dark habits and things that form around that. And there's it's a very political world too, between countries, and there's a lot that goes
on. And Tanya Harding's story told us a lot about the politics of not being from the right part of the United States.
Yeah, there's a huge
playing the game of pretending you're an upper middle class
ice princess. Yeah, and that's, you know, what they look for. I think it's opened up a little more now, but still, there's just always going to be an element of that in that world. It's like horseback riding, you know, very fancy show world. So, yeah, and then from there, how I led into the Wind Phone. But actually, another project I had worked on, and you're like, wow, this girl's really crazy. I had come up with an idea that I wanted to write something about the modern world of East LA gangs and, like, what that looked like. I was a big fan of The Wire.
Yeah. I knew this was coming up because you mentioned it at the Q&A at Film Invasion in June.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned the project you did.
Yeah, it was, it was a year of research, and I came from it from the other side of the ponds. A lot of people, when they do research like this, ride around with police officers and kind of stay on that side of the fence. But I had spent some time at Homeboy Industries and befriended a lot of ex-gang members that were reforming themselves and developed a very close relationship with one who became my main kind of consultant for the show, besides some gang detectives. You know, I did have that influence as well. But yeah, I spent a lot of time kind of crafting this as I was going to shoot it as a short, and then it got picked up by Full Screen, and they're like, let's do this as a series. So sometimes that happens too, and I was like, well, I have a week to figure out how to turn this into a series.
Right, all of a sudden you needed an outline of 20 episodes instead of just
making a short.
Yeah,
and they want to know every season too, yeah. So
and then an estimate of season 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, it was super intense. I remember that experience. And so it was kind of my first pitch on a show, because other things I'd written, the other pilot was like, oh, you know, the generals were like, we like your writing, but, you know, what else do you have? When you're like, oh, why am I here then?
Yeah, in fact, I always thought the best thing to do in a meeting is to come in with like your 5 ideas and give the ones you don't like out first and say, this is the best. And then you say, this one I'm not sure about. And then you tell them that and they want to prove that it's like, then they can own it a little more.
Yeah, there's a lot of
psychology.
That's
the one I'm going to pick.
Yeah, that goes on. It's, sometimes you just don't know what to say. And sometimes you feel like it's a sanity check too, because they're thinking about, oh, maybe we can put this person on a project that we have or staff in the future. So, that turned into its own thing, and it became very time consuming because I didn't have a writer's room. So I had to write all 10 episodes alone. They were 20 minute, but still it's a lot, to take on alone. And so we were close to getting into pre-production because I was also attached to direct all 10 episodes, which never happens.
Right.
So it was a really kind of like a dream come true.
Was that because they saw East Ramadi and they knew they could trust you?
Yeah. They had seen my first short. Yeah. East Ramadi. And they were like, yeah, we're super down for her to direct this. And then Full Screen and Churn got shut down by Churn and AT&T because they were owned by both of these corps. And they just didn't feel like their streaming was doing well enough. And that was the reason why they were trying to up their content.
Right. So this series was for streaming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so then I, they were like, another producer who had been interested in it, who was, you know, at a very kind of prestigious company and, you know, would only probably look at it as a 1 hour drama. I was like, I love this, develop into 1 hour drama. And after spending so much time crafting this world, which really needed to be a 1 hour drama to have the appropriate character development into this shorter form, which, you know, it, the character development is still there. It's just, it's more challenging, I think, in shorter form because you just don't have the time, to spend with your characters as,
yeah.
And that's just, so it's a challenge.
It normally takes a full season in a 30-minute show to get the characters across.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tough. So, she was like, all right, rewrite it to 1 hour. And at that moment I was just like, oh God, it was just
that's
mentally,
that's a big ask, especially now that you know the odds of it happening.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, and yeah, what is, you know, but I was super passionate at the project, but it just wasn't, that's why I say too, sometimes you have to step away. It wasn't coming to me how I needed to break this out. So, I had to step away, and that's when the Wind Phone, it had been a story I'd heard about. So I have a list, you know, of stories or potential feature ideas. And that for me, was a story that I was like, this would be a wonderful short film. And I always kind of knew how I'd want to approach it after I heard about it at NPR. And I watched bits of the documentary concerning the Wind Phone. And, you know, just to explain the story, should I?
Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, it's really, really, I guess, a piece of emotional history tied to a historical event in Japan. But after the tsunami, a private citizen opened up a phone booth on his property that he had used to grieve the death of a relative. And it obviously had no connecting line. And he opened it up to survivors. And, you know, 25,000 people now to date have actually gone to visit it. It's,
and he just said, use this to talk to
the people
you've lost.
Yeah, I think he wanted to,
open people, up that. And people just got it.
They did, and I think it was especially in Japanese culture, which is, you know, they tend to be more repressed in their expression of their emotions. From my understanding of talking with even a lot of the actors who were all from Japan. It was such a, like, a void that was needed for so many people to freely express their grief. And NPR did, This American Life actually too, did a great...
Yeah, they did a wonderful report on it.
It haunted me. Like, it haunted me. And then I went to check out the documentary, but I didn't really look at it too much because I didn't want to be influenced.
Yeah.
But I saw that cinematically, that there would need some creative liberties to be taken in order for the story to get the emotional impact and grab the attention of viewers. I was like, it'd have to be done in a way, you know, where the reality was a little surreal and we didn't really understand what was going on. And, for the tone to be something unexpected for something that could be super melodramatic. And just that the natural phone booth also was pained. It was very hard to see inside. So I saw with the documentary, like the stories were haunting and painful, but I was like, imagine if you could bring someone, you know, viewers inside to this reality and make them live the ride of this person's grief and their reality in a world where they didn't know right away what they were living. In terms of being able to place why all these strangers were here. So, you know, I'd want to do the story. And then, you know, this time it was just like all these things came together like this. I wasn't now directing the show and I had to rewrite it. And then I also had the death of my grandmother. And so it was like, that was such an emotional catalyst. I have so much regret around that, about not seeing her. And it literally was like 2 weeks
right,
before I was supposed to be there.
Across the country for the last, for 5 to 7 years,
yeah,
I'm assuming.
Yeah. So I just, yeah, I just, oh God, it was like every reason that I, you know, had not gone to visit her, which just seemed so trivial. I had so much regret. And I had these, you know, reminders to call grandma every Sunday. And I actually took the time to say some things. And then I was like, this is exactly, you know what I mean? Like, I needed my own kind of Wind Phone. And then the story really emotionally resonated with me because I didn't have the luxury to go to Japan and kind of live through the kind of immersive research period that I had with some other films. But it was, you know, this was kind of different for me, that it was something in my own life that had really triggered it. And that, this was something that I was like, I'm so usually very journalistic and about being very like true to life. And while this was very true to the experience, I took some creative liberties. It was a little more surreal and had an eeriness to it and kind of ethereal quality that I decided to bring to it. So it was fun to kind of like, to allow that freedom with this and that fun with the
project. Yeah, well, you created it from scratch, really, even though it was inspired by the truth.
Yeah, all the characters were created from scratch.
Yeah, yeah, we hear
the story.
Every character we meet and the way you wrote it and the way you presented it. I remember telling you at the Q&A that, like, one of the things I love so much about the Wind Phone is as you watch it, each person's personal story. So a lot of people would have done the thing that would have annoyed me, which is like have this super recognizable progression of stories getting closer and closer. But instead, it's so masterful the way you take us through each person's emotions and loss and survivor's guilt and stuff. And then like the way the water is not even mentioned till like the last gentleman.
Yeah, I wanted, yeah.
Like it was just so, it, you know. You created something completely original, really, for it.
Yeah, and then sometimes I think that's such a beautiful thing to be able to do is, you know, sometimes take the inspired by version, because sometimes that's just needed for certain stories to have the cinematic impact or emotional impact that the story actually deserves. And I just knew that punch at the end and, you know, that realization, especially for people who had no clue about this, the disaster. Surprisingly, some people were like, oh, I didn't even know there was, I'm like, oh God.
I don't know if I told you, the funny thing for me is I watched it and I thought it was beautiful. And so then I showed it to the life partner and she went, that's the NPR story. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. Like I just watched it completely on its own. And even though I'd heard the This American Life, I've heard every This American Life for like 15 years.
Yeah, I love them.
But I didn't make the connection. I actually didn't make the connection. She made the connection. And I was like, you're right. It is based on
that. Good for her. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a little smarter than me.
It happens. Yeah, so it's and viewers have different experiences depending on their knowledge or not having any knowledge of it. Or some one programmer was like, I knew it had to do with the tsunami, but I wasn't sure what. He's like, and that's what he liked about it. He's like, I couldn't really see where, like, I didn't. Usually when I watch a short film, I know where it's going because he's so used to watching that format, I guess.
Oh, yeah, you can't. When you watch 500 films in a month, you're going to start guessing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's just human nature. And so he's like, I really couldn't see where it was going. And there was, you know, it was a very detailed piece. Cause I mean, every piece of dialogue, it kind of really poured over to make sure that it was always just on the line of, if you rewatch it, you're like, you know, each story, yeah. you can find
each story has a beginning, middle and end. Everyone is three acts.
Yeah. So I created three acts with each one and a different theme, a different form of grief that each person was dealing with, because that's what I thought was so interesting too, is, how grief is such a universal human experience, but then so unique in how each person experiences it and deals with it.
Yeah. And you have your angry grief and your sorrowful grief.
Denial, shame. Guilt.
And projection, the girl who's projecting about the pet.
She's
obviously not as upset about the pet as she is about losing
her father. But she, this guilt that she never told. Sometimes it's the strangest things we attach to or moments when someone passes.
It's very human. And it's funny, if you, it wouldn't surprise anyone, I don't think, if you sat down in a Q&A after that film at a festival and said, I interviewed 100 survivors and I picked the 7 best stories. It's very tangible, you know?
Yeah.
The stories are so tangible.
I really had to step into each character, even through my own grief, and think about different expressions. And even the fourth character, who's played by Miho Ando, who's just all the actors were fantastic. There was just so much talent in that group.
There really was. It's funny. I thought it was wonderful that one of your actors won Best Acting Individual. But when I saw that she won, I was like, how did they pick her?
I think she said the same thing. She was like, well, I think her scene was what's so difficult about the first scene is that there is really no dialogue.
Yeah.
And she communicates such a story without, you know, our use of words. And that she takes does. A lot. She has a very strong presence.
Everyone's wonderful.
But yeah, Miho Endo, the fourth one, she was the character who we talked about Blanche from Streetcar.
The one whose husband had cheated?
Yeah, and she had created a story that maybe he was still out. You know, the idea that he could still be out there with her lover was almost more comforting than accepting that he was just lost in the ocean. Because for so many people, too, when you don't have a body, and that's why I liked using the ocean as a character in this, because even on the set, they said when you stepped into the booth, it was so surreal. Like, you got the chills. Like, right away, people would cry and just had such an experience because the ocean, it was just, you felt like the power of this.
Yeah, your actors, you didn't have to direct them much, did you?
Well, were all naturally, you know, we did a lot of rehearsals together. They all had a lot of talent, raw talent. But to really, some of them were so talented that sometimes too, it's like reeling some people back, and each act is so different, but to really find the truth of the story for each actor. So, you know, I had these characters I created and we just kind of came up with backstories together during the rehearsals. You know, I let them kind of weigh in on that backstory so that they could really have a truth in this themselves, and, or if they wanted to personalize, you know, a name or what they bring. So there was an extensive rehearsal process, but they were all so talented. In fact, during the casting, I was like, we didn't know what to expect. And I only wanted Japanese natives that had grown up in Japan and had a true experience of this disaster.
Yeah, Japanese you would know was accurate.
Yes, good. Not Japanese American. Just because I wanted, it was so important for me that the authenticity of this story was there in terms of culture. And so I knew that was really important. Yeah. And there was so much talent that came in. I was like, I need more parts.
Right. You wanted to see.
Because there's not a lot of parts, you know.
So there were wonderful actors you didn't get to use.
No, but I wish I had had more parts because there's a lot of talent that came in. I think we got the best of the best just because there's not a lot of parts.
Yeah.
For them, and a lot of actors said how, you know, exciting it was to get a piece where it wasn't like, you know, a token role or just the usual
stereotype, not a token.
Yeah. These were of characters with like
not just
death.
Sitting at the computer at the police station being told, hey, get the thing for me.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Or like, you know, the weird Asian guy, you know, like how there's these roles and, you know, it's just, it was really exciting for them. They were really surprised when they saw me in the room as the writer. Because
they expressed that. Yeah.
Yeah, the story felt, it was written in English, but the story felt very, like, even the way that I wrote it in English, they felt like it was almost translated from Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And I had spent a lot of time, I'm a big Koreeda fan. He did Shoplifters and another movie I'm going to talk about a little bit later.
Good.
But he, I watched a lot of his work, so I kind of got a feel for, like, their rhythm and the way they express emotion and...
I remember doing the show of hands at the Q&A where I said, who, while you were watching this, expected to see that it was shot in Japan by a Japanese director? And, like, I think more than half the hands went up.
Well, that was it was last night. We were at the Japan Film Festival, and I was the only non-Japanese director, and then to be honored, too. So it was...
Yeah, and you won, yeah.
Yeah, so it was just... It was so exciting to be... that was the most important thing to me. That's so... I think, you know, for me, when... Because I tend to step out of, you know, even when I did the gang project, that was mostly in English, but it's still another language, really, essentially. And so it's so important for me that when you step into other works, I think it's so wonderful to get other stories told that may not be getting attention and to be that vehicle. But at the same time, you have such a great responsibility to honor the world and the voice of the world and to make sure that it is true to the voices that inhabit these worlds.
Sure is nice to have filmmakers who respect other cultures instead of what we grew up on, which was, you know, generally just the white male's view of the planet.
Well, even like Lone Survivor, which is a film with Mark Wahlberg, a wartime film. They shot in this village and some of the refugees I spoke with were like, they have the wrong language.
Yeah.
Like, for that region. Like, it wasn't... And, so, you know, for some people, those details just aren't important. It still was a very entertaining film and, you know, I'm sure hit the mark for people. But for me as a director, that's just something that's just not acceptable. And I'm just like, if you have that budget, how do you not...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Get that detail there.
Have you submitted to films in Japan? I mean, film festivals in Japan?
Yeah, we screened in Tokyo and we also screened in Hong Kong. Right now, we premiered in March at Cinequest, which is a great festival. And as of now, I think we're slotted. We've screened at quite a few, but total right now, 40 festivals. And it's like so many different countries, too, from like Serbia to Indonesia to Hong Kong to Ireland to Malta to Africa. And that was something else with this story that I felt that even though it was such a special story of Japanese history, I felt that it was a story that could really resonate with anyone.
Because it's really a story about loss.
Yeah, and how to deal with that.
You know, birth, school, work, death, right? I mean, that's our lives.
Especially today, too, when there's so many lives being lost suddenly. I mean, we have school shootings and so many of these disasters and, you know.
But also grandparents.
And grandparents, it just even could be this so simple as, you know, I mean, there's been visitors to this phone booth that weren't part of the disaster that are coping with the death. And so I think everybody, when someone close to you dies, there's always going to be some things you wish you had said or moments that sit with you of regret or, you know, you wish you had more time or something you wish you didn't say, you know?
Yeah. But losing other people we love and care about, that's just one of the most human stories there is.
Yeah, and I love stories that can bridge culture and connect us as one world.
Yeah, it's universal. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because the truth is, you know, no matter what walk of life you're from, when you sit down with another human being and you're really open to listening and sharing, you will always find common ground.
Yeah.
It's just the fears that, you know, and a lot of people, you know, too, sometimes in filmmaking, you know, people want people only to make certain kind of films or kind of segregate us. Like, these are the kind of stories you can tell because you're this person. And so you fit into this world. And for me, I just, if a story resonates with me and I feel like I can bring something to the table emotionally or, you know, I can step into the world and research and, you know, bring characters to life that I find there. I see no reason why not to step into that world, especially if the story's not being told and it's something that brings value. So again, it's just like having that responsibility and care to, approach it that way.
Well, I'm not surprised at the embrace your film has received worldwide.
Yeah. It's just like startling. And so
I guess, I mean, yeah, you don't have the ego to say, well, they're going to take me everywhere. But it's really not surprising.
It's still surreal. And it's so scary because it was a film, too, that, you know, I'm like, oh, this will be so much easier than East Ramadi, you know, because we're in a phone booth.
Yeah.
But no. Because this film, what was so challenging about it is it every second can change the intonation of the film because you're in this confined space. There's nowhere to go. There's no room for, like, a bad performance. You can get taken out of it so quickly. Even the editing process, the sound design process was so extensive. I had like 40 notes and it's a great sound designer. It's called This Is Sound Design. They work on huge features. And the designer was like, 40 notes? And I was like, I didn't use music. I used the nature sounds.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you didn't use music.
I just was like, that is so wrong.
So glad
I knew
you didn't
from the start.
Music.
The producer was like, oh, let's
wind,
get it.
You have the waves, the ocean.
I felt like the nature was a natural melody.
If you had like lightly touched piano, I would have been
be
like,
disaster. It would destroy the sanctity of the moment. Yeah. And you need also would inform viewer how to feel and and be begging for it. And I was like, this doesn't need it. The performances were there.
So such a good choice.
Yeah. So, I love music and I mean, there's films that I'm like that song and that scene in that moment is so brilliant. But I'm also a big believer. Like I think, you know, when in editing, like if a scene doesn't stand without music, it's not a good day.
Absolutely.
Like the music is great to enhance if it's the right thing. But I think a film like this, I was just like, no to music and
no.
Yes to nature. And we can use that. So that, you know, but it was very intricate in terms of, you know, I did a very internal, and there's a lot in this film. If you keep looking for it, you'll notice there's like an internal sound reality and external sound reality, where sometimes the sound is elevated. It's where we're in the character's mind, almost, of what emotionally they're experiencing or what they're remembering versus like the actual intensity of the sound. So there's a lot of details if you want, like keep looking, and a lot of the imagery even was very like carefully chosen. My cinematographer, John Kang, who's from Singapore, actually, he's a very masterful, director of photography. And, he just captured so many of the beautiful, images at this location. There was a lot of magic that happened on the set weather-wise, that just, 'cause a lot of it too, we couldn't control it. We were up to Mother Nature in this, in terms of what the lighting would present itself. 'Cause we had ideas of what I wanted it to be for the mood, but I didn't know if nature was going to cooperate.
Right. You can control how sunny it was. Mm-mm. During and how, one yeah. performance to the next.
No. And it was great because the overcast lasted a very long time, unusually long that day for the third scene, with the grandmother and our two granddaughters. And it's just exactly what I wanted, 'cause she was so, you know, in that guilt, that darkness of guilt. So it was just, we were just like, wow, the weather, it was, the gods were smiling upon us. It was a very, very calm set, very quiet set. And it was just, everyone was just smiling there. It was, I mean, of course there were some stressful moments because the grandmother was late, and like, there was a few things that were like, oh, but overall, it was just like...
Was it another weekend shoot or one...
Yeah, two-day shoot.
2 days.
Yeah, and it was just...
But the truth is, you did have the room to work with, because, yeah, all these moments could be weeks apart in within the story. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't a one-day tale, so yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of room. And it could be. That was the thing, too. I wanted to leave it for interpretation. You know what I mean? And for people to like the story, like, is this all happening over one day? Is this different? You know what I mean? Like, I like leaving that room open a little bit, because we start in on the first day, which is the day before the anniversary.
But you do show times. So yeah. It is kind of all one day. But I'm way out, is, I'm out of line.
But the thing is, for some viewers, they could think it was, you know, but I didn't want to be soaked. I put the time cards in too, because, and the inspired in the beginning by true events, because I knew right away that it presented a question to viewers of where, how this was all connected. And for something that, especially with the attention spans we have today, like, I was like, this story kind of needs that question to be presented. So it's supposedly that, but some people took it, you know, what I liked about it too is some people had different interpretations about each character or, you know, the time span of it. But it, you know, I like that, because I think it's just, that was what I really wanted for that piece, is for everyone to, you know, to have their own experience of it. And so many people have very different experiences or characters that they gravitated towards, or interpretations of what their stories were, because, you know, it's never fully clear, like, each character at the end, like, where was he? What exactly happened? You know, it kind of leaves it up to the viewers' imaginations to piece together.
For sure. The events behind. You're just giving us little moments, and then we fill the rest in with our minds, whether we want to do it on purpose or not.
Yeah. And it's just natural. Yeah. So I was happy that we were able to create that space for people and to have that, you know, different experience. So I have to say that shooting this was really lovely. Like, it was, I wish everyone was like, oh, this set was just, it was just so delightful. And so, I wish all sets could be like that in the future, but it was just, there was also such a strong relationship between the cast and the crew and everyone. And
yeah. And the material, the cast and the material, I'm sure everyone felt that they were involved in something pretty special.
They did. Yeah. And it was beautiful to like have that. And I'm also the kind of director that I'll talk to every extra on set and PA and make sure they understand the story and feel valued. I'm very into collaborative environment. And I know there has to be hierarchy, but I feel like everyone is to be valued. And I like to make forms open if someone wants to, you know, if someone, set designer or, you know, any key position too, if, you know, to be open to share their ideas, because, you know, I think that's another mark, is knowing when to take a good idea.
So you're moving on creatively. You already have stuff You're one of those wonderful artists who has a list. You have lots of ideas in your back pocket.
Yeah, it sometimes makes you feel a little schizophrenic at times because your mind is in so many different spaces. But yeah, I'm working on a thriller right now that with a producer that was a work for hire, but really became my own project.
So you were hired to write it.
Yeah, so that it's really exciting, and it's a thriller, but it has a social aspect to it, and it's a very unusual story in the protagonist. So I really kind of fell in love with it because I'm the kind of person too. I can't, you know, when it comes to, you know, you need to get jobs and everyone needs to earn money and all of that. But I would never take on a project that I wasn't in love with or I couldn't make my own because I'm not going to be able to do it any justice and it's going to be a fruitless exercise. So it should go to someone who loves it, you know, who's going to inhabit that world. So yeah, I'm working on that. And then I did finally rewrite that pilot in the 1 hour mm-hmm. form. So it was just finished actually very recently and is going out again to some great producers. And then I'm also attached to a feature.
And that was a wonderful conversation with Kristen Gerwick. You know, I urged you before this to spread the word about the Wind Phone, so I'm just going to do it again. Seriously, let's get a little grassroots here. There is a film called The Wind Phone, which has a shot at being on the short list for the films nominated for Best Live Action Short at the Oscars next year. And it'd be so cool if that happened. Come on, man. Make it happen. Come on, everybody. Jump in. And now let me wrap this up. So discoveryindiefilm.com, that's where you can find a ton of great shorts embedded, as well as all the podcasts. You also can get information about the TV series, which is streaming now on Amazon Prime Video. 2 seasons, 10 episodes per season. Each episode's around 30 minutes. All fantastically great short films. Just start watching it. And you know what? Why don't you review it? Yeah, watch it and review it. We just did wrap up the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, which is every November. Film Invasion Los Angeles is coming in June. So that's accepting films now. So Film Invasion LA is filminvasionla.com. Sherman Oaks Film Festival is shermanoaksff.com. And I think that's all I got to say. I don't know, I'm kind of rusty. All right, thanks for listening. Thank you.